I want to start this morning with two confessions. First, when Christ shall come with shout of acclamation and carry me home, what joy shall fill my heart? And I will bow in humble adoration and there proclaim, my God, how great thou art. That's one of my favorite verses from one of my favorite hymns in all of church music. I don't think about it. I just sing it. I thought about it a little bit more this week, and I'll get to that. My second confession, this whole choice of Left Behind as a sermon title was really a joke. Before this week, I'd never read a single Left Behind book or seen a bad movie, according to critics, from 2000, or a slightly less bad movie from 2014. People are entitled to create whatever stories they want. People are free to make them up completely, to base them upon actual events or embellish history. It never bothers me. And I didn't expect this Left Behind series to bother me. I even had some ideas about it. I thought I might start with something like an excerpt from The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. There's this part where Jim uses a hairball from the stomach of an ox to help Huck see his future. Do you remember this? It goes something like this. Jim promises Huck that he might have trouble. He might have happy times. He might get sick. Might be healthy. He might be in trouble. He might stay safe. Covered just about every possibility. I figured Left Behind might be a little like that, vague and benign. Or I thought I could take sort of the same direction I'd taken when preaching about this scripture before. I would start by providing a snapshot of the temple in Jerusalem so that the disciples' reaction could be put in context. You know, you saw that picture. But to give you a better feel, you need to know that the exterior of this temple was built with huge white stones. Many of those were overlaid with pure gold. And some of those stones were 60 feet long and over 7 feet high and 9 feet wide. To give you a visual, think of 4 Chevy Suburbans, not those ones they have now, but the old ones, like the ones we used to, you know. Think of 4 Chevy Suburbans end to end, one stone. In the words of one ancient historian, the temple loomed over the city like a snow-clad mountain. Now, if you can imagine that's just one stone in that massive structure I showed you, you'll be able to relate to the disciples' immediate anxiety, the breath-catching fear when they hear Jesus say, as for what you see, there won't be one stone left on another. And I can't even imagine their fear, but what they wanted to know immediately was, when will this be? What will be the sign that this is about to happen? I don't know how they thought they could possibly stay safe from something that was going to upend and destroy that temple, but still, they wanted to know, when is this going to happen and how will we know that it's going to happen? And some of us, you know, we think we can relate to their panic because we've seen buildings 10 times that size brought to the ground in New York City. But I want to point out one very big difference. Though we have seen buildings of a similar size destroyed, never have we seen one of the same significance destroyed. For remember, the inner courts of the temple were the courts of God, the dwelling place of God. For the dwelling place of God to be destroyed would surely be the end of the world. The end of the world as the Jews knew it. In that context, think about what Jesus was saying. Beware, no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, don't be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes. There will be famines. This is only the beginning. All right. Now, for those of you who also haven't read or seen the movies in the Left Behind series, a little context. In the Left Behind series of these end time novels, which were co-authored by Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins, true Christians, along with every child on earth, have suddenly vanished in the rapture. And those, quote, left behind face the prospect of 7 years of hell on earth before Jesus returns in power. That event, Jesus returning in power, is detailed in the 12th book in the series. In the Left Behind books, the United Nations has fallen under the control of the Antichrist, who has a name, Nicolae Carpathia, who has risen to power as Secretary General, and he has used the UN to achieve global domination. Unbelievers of all kinds fall under the Antichrist's spell, which is cloaked in appealing rhetoric of world peace, brotherhood, and disarmament. Now, where did this idea for Left Behind come from? Well, it came from an idea called dispensationalism. Dispensationalism. There are supposedly anywhere from, I think, 3 to 8, but the most common number chosen is 7. 7 dispensations, 7 time periods, 7 seasons. And this is what they are, very quickly. Season 1, or dispensation 1, is the time of innocence, and that's the time when Adam and Eve lived in the Garden of Eden before the fall. Dispensation 2, a time of conscience from after the fall to Noah's flood. Dispensation 3, the time of human government after Noah's flood, when humans were responsible for their own laws and civility. That ended with the Tower of Babel. 4th dispensation, promise. That was the time from Abraham to Moses, when God made God's promise to Abraham that I will be your God and you will be my people. 5th is the dispensation of the law. That began with Moses and the giving of the law. And this is where it gets important for us. It ended with the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Dispensation 6, from the cross to the rapture of the church. The rapture is followed by the wrath of God. That's where Left Behind has us. That period of the rapture of the church. All the faithful and all the innocent young children and babies are snatched up to heaven. If you wonder why I'm using this picture, it's because wherever anyone disappeared, wherever they were snapped up in the rapture, they left their clothes behind, neatly folded. I started researching the sermon. I started several weeks ago. I talked to a colleague of mine whose church has been studying the book of Revelation. I bought a copy of Revelation for Dummies. Then I remembered, Dummy, we're studying the book of Mark. So I put that one aside. I bought a copy of Left Behind, and as I began to read it, I had that experience that people have at a car accident. It's really bad, but I couldn't look away. I had to read it. As a former English teacher, I hate when people jump on the bandwagon to burn books that they had, or ban books, I guess we don't burn them, to ban books when they haven't even read the book. I secretly gloat when the really bad books slip right through without any censoring because they are more difficult, and so no one bothered to read them. My experience of being immersed in this Left Behind book in this literary world made me literally physically sick. I'm only exaggerating a little bit. If you were here last week, you might have noticed that allergies started to overtake me at the end of the service, and I left our new members class a little bit early. Now that coughing and sneezing in public are more high stakes than they used to be. So I admit that I was getting sick a little bit, but reading Left Behind and chasing down some of the questions that the book raised for me dragged me into a deep sickness of my soul. You might think that's extreme, naive, even impossible. There's real evil in the world, you might say. People are dying of hunger and fire and water and COVID. You can get past a little book. I carried on. You know, at the beginning, it was some pretty basic stuff that got to me. The audacity of anyone claiming to know when the end of times would come, because, you know, Jesus said over and over, no one knows when the time will come. Even I don't know when the time will come, Jesus said. Not only when the end of time would come, but the exact markers and the exact events. I really kind of thought that this sermon would be as easy as raising those words up. No one knows. But that clearly hasn't been enough for lots of people. I didn't make it to book 12, as you know, but I read about all of them and I made my way through the first one. In the beginning, reading about the people left behind and the people raptured, I agonized over some pretty simple things. I agonized over all those people who worship gods other than the one I worship, and how they were marked for trial and tribulation. I worried because it seemed to me that, well, let me back up and say that in book 12, you know, Jesus comes back. I think it's kind of a Rambo Jesus, and powerful and. And what I want to say is that was wrong the first time, and so I think it's probably wrong the next time. Jesus didn't come in as that Rambo character. He came in as a humble, honest man riding on a donkey. Not a political power or a military power. Just those kinds of things bothered me so much about the book. Then I had an idea. I thought, I hadn't read about anybody in this whole book that was gay. I guess all the gay people went straight to heaven. So I started searching for that LGBTQ in the Left Behind series, and I couldn't find anything. So I must have been right. And I was just about to quit. And one match popped up. Not to LGBTQ, but to the word homosexual. I tracked it down. LGBTQ people aren't really dealt with until the 13th. The prequel to the Left Behind series. It's called The Rising, and I want to share a little bit about it with you. The Rising deals with Rayford Steele. He's the hero of book 1 through 12. The Rising deals with Rayford Steele's childhood and college days and how he nearly married another woman. A conflict between father and son as Ray decides to become an airline pilot against his father's wishes figures prominently in the book. Listen carefully. Also featured is the birth of Nicolae Carpathia, who would later rise up in Nicolet as the Antichrist. Listen. Marilena is a simple Romanian woman who is overcome by her need to have a baby. Her husband, Soren, does not love his wife anymore and is revealed to be a homosexual. Thus, Marilena reads an ad for a group to find something beyond herself, and she meets Viviana. Viviana is a Russian who talks with the spirit world. She is a Luciferian and says that loyalty to her Lord can bring Marilena the baby she wants so badly. Are you hearing all these parts? However, this baby that Marilena so desperately wants will come through genetic engineering with the best traits of two sperm mixed into a hybrid sperm, which will be fused with her egg. At first, it is unknown who Nicolai's, the Antichrist's, two biological fathers are. Later, they are found out to be Soren, Nicolai's homosexual father, and Soren's male lover. I have never wanted a book to be banned, but perhaps I've found the one. We can get into trouble. When we start thinking about these end times and who's worthy of rapture and who will be left behind to fight. When we try to figure out who's worthy of the rapture and who's not. When we try to make sense of it all and figure out what the signs say and who's the Antichrist. William Countryman decries this way of trying to analyze our faith and figure out all the signs. He writes that the dominance of dogmatic or systematic theology in Western Christianity has created the unfortunate illusion that the gospel is simply a system of ideas which can be fully comprehended by any person of adequate intelligence, listen to this, quite apart from the teaching of Jesus as presented in the Gospels. Countryman says that such a systematic approach is contrary to the entire message of the Gospels, which is not about creating a systematic theology, but is about transforming those who hear it. Countryman speaks wistfully of an earlier time when a theologian was not primarily a scholar, but was rather a person whose, quote, encounter with God shaped the person with such power that he or she could speak of God with the authority of grace. With the authority of grace. That is what is totally missing from these books. I get that people want to figure it all out. It gives them a sense of control. If I check these boxes, I won't be left behind. But it gets me focused on my own self. And if it really goes bad, I start focusing on myself and the rapture, and I get focused on all that and I miss opportunities to love others here on earth. It's this kind of explanation of the church with no grace and the church with no heart that drives people away from the church. I'm telling you, trying to scare the hell out of people is never the way to get people to believe in Jesus. We get people to understand Jesus by doing what Madeline L. Engle said. She says, we do not draw people to Christ by loudly discrediting what they believe, by telling them how wrong they are and how right we are, but by showing them a light that is so lovely that they want with all their heart to know the source of it. She writes a book in which the evil one is overcome by, do you remember this? I love you, Charles Wallace. I love you, Charles Wallace. I want to close with this because all this has weighed so heavily on my heart this week, and we're still in this COVID thing, and people don't know whether they should come back to church or not come back to church, and there's all this stuff circulating, and then there's stuff like Left Behind, so I want to share this. One of my friends who's a pastor posted something to the, it sort of went like this. Yes, you should come back to church. Church needs you. And you need the church. And I want to say, especially to those of you who are watching, there are reasons and good ones why you are watching. And please don't hear anything I'm saying as an admonishment of you for worshiping with us online. Thank you for being there and for being part of the community. But I'm talking about the people who will never come back to church. This is what a guy wrote, and I don't know him. He wrote this. Usually I would agree with the let's get together at church, yeah. But two things bug me about these statements and other calls back to worship. First, the sentiment that one needs a church is a falsehood. I've had more godly experiences and seen the work of Christ from sitting on my couch than I have anywhere else in the world. I've seen more moments of people truly being Christ-like walking down the street or sitting on the train. I've had more experiences with the graceful nature of humans in the street and at work than ever before in a church. Myself and many others have witnessed firsthand how cruel those, quote, communities of faith can be. The power of a room full of believers can be something so heinously vile and so disgustingly cross that, in fact, it chases people away from God. My faith tells me that my relationship with whatever may be watching over us is just that, a private relationship with my Creator. If one needs the attention of the crowds or if one desires a validation from the masses, are we genuinely serving our God? Or are we serving our own need to be seen serving God? The stories I remember say Christ walked around with just over 12 people. He didn't sit in a building with 5,000. To further that sentiment, are church leaders begging people to come back to Christ and share the glory of that love and internal support? Or are they asking people to come back for their tithes and offerings? Are you chasing all the members down or just those that tithe their 10%? I beg that you don't discredit those of us who don't attend your worship. We see our gods in the small things. We see them in the moment a stranger holds a door, the moment an unexpected mother picks up a sock for a new mother, the way that man just shows up and takes care of his neighbor, the way people look at two men or two women holding hands and smile. Don't discredit people just because we worship in silence. Silence is sometimes the only way to truly hear your calling. This morning, I want to finish up with some words that I wrote back to Benjamin. Benjamin, you and I don't know each other, so I almost didn't reply, even though I really, really wanted to. I don't disagree with anything you've said. I've had many of those God experiences that you describe. As a member of the LGBTQ community, I love that you can see God while looking at two women holding hands and also see God in the smiles that you and others turn upon them. There's a popular open letter circulating right now that assures us that we don't need to go back to the churches, that we can encounter God anywhere. It's absolutely true. And it is also true that Jesus invited us to be his body. Yes, Jesus was closest to and seemingly shared his life intimately with only a few dozen people. But I think those few dozen represented most of the strengths and weaknesses of our human nature. Messy and broken. And healing. Sometimes the church seems to be more than content with its messy self and pushes away as undesirable the very ones who are seeking healing. Sometimes our own brokenness is more than we can bear and we refuse to acknowledge it and so can't take the first steps toward true healing. And yet, it is an amazing blessing and privilege when we find a gathering that acknowledges all these things and still promises each other to give our best selves to this grand experiment of being the body of Christ, of being church together, with no one left behind.